Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, Episode 9, for February 13th, 2008. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me. This is the official podcast of BrainyGamer.com. You know, there are a lot of unofficial podcasts out there claiming to be associated with the BrainyGamer.com, but they're simply imposters, all of them. And I can assure you that this podcast, the one you are listening to at this moment, is the official podcast of BrainyGamer.com. So, welcome. If you haven't been to the blog, I hope you'll come over for a visit. It's www.brainygamer.com, and I welcome your comments and feedback on any of the posts. You can pretty much count on a new post on some game-related subject every day, and I appreciate the community that's formed around the blog. Very much appreciate the community, and I'd love to have you join us. This episode is going to be all about games. Now, you know, there's all supposed to be about games, right? Because this is a gaming podcast. But I'm going to really focus on particular games in my first segment today. I've been playing a lot of games and have some observations to make about some of those that I think might be helpful if you haven't tried them. And a few exciting notes about a game, of course, that none of us have played called Spore. Probably the most anticipated game in the history of video games. I don't think that's an overstatement. This is Will Wright's masterpiece, possibly, or it could be a flaming disaster. We don't know. But some really interesting new details emerged about that, and I want to talk briefly about that as well. I also have an interview in this podcast with one of my favorite bloggers on the internet. His name is Mitch Grappata. He runs a blog called Insult Sword Fighting, which, if you're a Secret of Monkey Island fan, you get that joke. And a terrific guy and a wonderful interview. He was willing to spend a bit of time with me yesterday, and I recorded the interview, and I have it for you today. My thought is that I do a lot of reading of blogs and subscribe to quite a few of them related to gaming, and some of them are so great, and I get so much out of them and learn so much from them, and I've thought, you know, I should be sharing some of this with my listeners. I would imagine that some of these blogs you may already know about if you frequent gaming blogs, but you know, it's very possible that you don't know about some of them, and if I can increase a little traffic towards some of these sites, it would make me very happy, because in Mitch's case in particular, he's an excellent writer. And you can count on articulate essays looking at games from his own perspective that is informed by, you know, really kind of deep reading of games, and also mixed with, a wonderful sense of fun. And he never forgets that games are fun, and I admire that about him as well. And finally, I have some listener email. I didn't get to any of those in the last podcast, and I apologize for that. Several of you have written me, and like I've said before, I always respond, and if I can respond in the podcast, I'll do that. Otherwise, you'll certainly hear from me with a reply via email. But I have some really good questions and comments that I'll include in this podcast and try to do a little catching up there. So that's the menu, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Away we go. I want to take a look at some games that I've been playing recently, but before I do that, I'm wondering if you've experienced something similar to what I've noticed happening to me lately, and it's this. There are just too many games. I can't possibly play all the games that I want to play. And I have this stack. Actually, it's not a stack. It's a shelf. It's a shelf of games. And as I'm recording this podcast, this shelf sits over my shoulder behind me, and I can turn and look at this shelf anytime I want, and I have the same reaction every time I see the shelf. I'm delighted at all these terrific games sitting there waiting for me to play them at any time, and I'm at the very same time completely frustrated by the fact that I can't get to them. And, you know, there are some amazing games on the shelf here. God of War, Civilization 4, which I spent a little bit of time with Civ 4, but I mean, if you've played that game, you know, it's a game that rewards you richly for the more time you put into it. I never played Day of the Tentacle, you know, the classic LucasArts game. I've never played it. Ratchet and Clank, Metal Gear Solid 2. And, if, you know, I mentioned this in my blog post on this subject the other day. The great, embarrassing, gaping hole in my gaming history is Final Fantasy VII. So, yes, that's right. I haven't played what many people think is the greatest RPG ever. Now, you know, some people also think it's highly overrated. I couldn't say because I have no firsthand experience with that game. Now, I feel like I know virtually everything there is to know about Final Fantasy VII because, you know, if you're a gamer, people talk about it nonstop, and I know there's a big death in it, and I won't give that away in case you haven't played it, but I know there's a lot of stuff in that game that people talk about, and I've heard them talk about it. But, you know, still, I should play it, right? I should have that experience. And there's a long list that I could rattle through here, and I won't bore you with it, but every day it seems like my list gets a little longer, and as games come out and I give them a look, I realize that there's another game that I'm not giving a look. So my solution has been renting games, and that's been quite useful. I use a service called Gamefly, and they've gotten a lot better recently at getting games to you quickly, and, you know, I can take a look at a game and you know, move along. I don't need to finish every game I play by any means, but if I'm enjoying a game or if I admire a game for any number of reasons, I want to finish it. And I'm a little crazy that way. I mean, I'm the kind of guy that watches the credits at the end of movies and things like that, because I feel this kind of strange sense of obligation to the people that made it. You know, they made all of it. They didn't make it just to the end of the last line of dialogue. They added credits. They put a little music under the credits. They, you know, maybe they'll surprise you with a little tidbit in the credits, which some movies do. And I want to see it. So I feel the same way about games. If it's a game that I admire or enjoy for whatever reason, the designers have designed a whole experience, and I want to have that experience. So, you know, that makes my job a lot harder, of course. Finishing these games requires a lot of time. But I do have the desire to do it. And it's odd. I see this shelf and I know that it's always there waiting for me. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling, but, you know, they're all just sitting there kind of beckoning to me. At any time, I could pick any of them up and play them. And day after day, week after week, they sit there unplayed or underplayed. And maybe someday I'll get to them. I am encouraged a little bit by the fact that I have been returning recently to some old games, and I've talked about them here on this podcast and on the blog. Music rhythm games, for example, things that I was having fun with that I should have played years ago and didn't. And now I've played them and finished them. So, you know, it's possible, but for now, my shelf is still pretty overflowing, and I'm making very little progress. Now, of course, the reason these games sit on my shelf is because I'm busy playing other games, and I want to talk about a few of those games now. And the first one, and by far the one that has my attention the most, is a game called No More Heroes. It's made by a company called Grasshopper, a Japanese design company headed by a guy by the name of Suda Goichi, who prefers to be called Suda 51. And this game has received a lot of attention on the net. A lot of bloggers have talked about this game, and you'll hear later in my interview with Mitch Kerpata, we'll talk about the game in a little bit because he admires it too. No More Heroes is a game that's made for gamers. It's a game that assumes that you have a bit of history with games and you are capable of kind of keeping up with it. It's a smart game. It assumes that you are willing and able to catch its kind of insider jokes. It's filled with references to previous games going all the way back to the 8-bit era. And it is a game like no other you've ever played. And, you know, you hear this a lot, right? And every game designer tells you, or every publisher says, this game is like no other game you've ever tried. And you play it, and it's pretty much like every other game you've ever tried. And so when I say that, you just got to trust me. And when you play it, I think you'll agree. It is an extraordinarily unique, individual signature game by Sudagoichi, who is, I think, establishing a reputation for himself as a genius, as a master game designer. No More Heroes is full of itself in a certain kind of wonderful way. It's got this real strong sense of kind of cocky exuberance about itself. It loves being a video game. It's a game that makes you feel that you're playing a video game. It doesn't hide that. It's it's a very kind of postmodern experience in many ways. And what it does really is it invites you into this crazy world occupied by this character named Travis Touchdown, which, you know, that name even by itself is these kind of ludicrous names. The town is called Santa Destroy. And all these kind of self-referential moments, all these nods to other games. The big reference point really that the game will throw at you right from the beginning is it appears to be a kind of a crazy riff on Grand Theft Auto. And it gives you a sense that you're in this open-ended kind of sandbox world. But really, Suda's just riffing on that in the sense that he doesn't really give you much to do, and he kind of strips it down in a way that kind of makes fun of the whole Grand Theft Auto conceit. And so you ride your motorcycle around and you can mow people down, but they're kind of sketchy looking characters, very uniform. Nobody really has a certain individual personality, and the jobs that you have to do in the game, in order to make money, are obviously ridiculous things like, you know, cleaning graffiti off of walls or cleaning up litter or gathering up stray cats. And that's how you make your money in the game. So throughout the process, you are playing the game and kind of comparing it and referencing it against other game experiences you've had. You'll find that a lot of the graphics are sort of purposely jagged out. The menus and the save points and things like that are these great big pixelated kind of vibrating colorful spots on the map that, again, look like they're from some old PS1 or even like SNES game. And it's a thrill ride for a gamer. It gives you a kind of a beautiful wrapped up present that says, hey, gamer, here's something that's going to be right up your alley. And it's a loving embrace. You know, you could say that what Suda's up to is kind of a cynical deconstruction of games like Grand Theft Auto, but really it's not. It's a kind of a simultaneously winky kind of parody, but also a kind of loving embrace of all those experiences you've had with other games. Now, having said all this, I don't mean to suggest that the game is kind of this ramshackle collection of silly game references. It also has a core experience with incredibly fine combat and action elements. You ascend the ranks of assassins, beginning with, I think you start as number 11 in the world or in the country, and you make your way up through the game to become number one. And I should tell you, it's an incredibly over-the-top violent game. It's over-the-top in the sense that it's just cartoonishly crazy bloody, you know, blood spewing everywhere, and, you know, tons and tons of profanity and all kinds of sexual innuendo. And, you know, it's a mature game. It is for mature gamers, so you should know that going in. But don't let that stop you, because all of those things matter. They aren't gratuitous. They add to the flavor of the game. Now, unfortunately, if you're a listener who doesn't live in the States, it's possible that, or likely, that you will get a somewhat censored version of the game. The Japanese version and the European version of the game, they depict the violence and the aftermath of the violence, the blood and stuff, as coins instead of blood, you know, sort of flying out of the corpse, and the spewing blood that you would get in the American version is, from what I understand, nowhere to be found, as well as other sort of graphic, violent elements of the game. That's a real shame because, you know, be a bit like watching an episode of The Sopranos or a Quentin Tarantino movie with all that stuff cleaned up. It sort of like takes the guts out of it and really neuters it in a certain kind of very unfortunate way. But anyway, I could go on and on about No More Heroes, and I refer you to the blog where you can find a couple of links to other articles and reviews of the game, and I encourage you to go read those. As usual, I don't review games in the podcast. I just sort of give you a series of impressions of them, but this is a must-play game, and I would go farther and say it's a must-own game. I'm developing a terrible track record of recommending games to my listeners that seem to inevitably fail at the box office. My first podcast, I talked about Odin Sphere, which died. No one bought it. The next podcast, I think it was the next one, I talked about Persona 3, and how much I love that game. You know, sold very few copies. I talked about Zack and Wiki. Please buy this game. It's a great game. Love this game. Very underrated. Nobody bought it. And so, you know, my brainy gamer kiss of death will probably continue with No More Heroes. It's sold nothing in Japan, unfortunately, apparently just dying over there. And it seems to be selling here in the States in places, but it's unclear at this point. I haven't seen any numbers really how well it's selling. We'll see. But, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you have a Nintendo Wii and you're looking for a different kind of gaming experience, you know, by all means, get to the store and purchase this game at full price. Reward this studio for making what I think is one of the most courageous video games ever made in the history of the medium. I mean, he really put himself out there with this game, Suda Goichi, and he deserves to be recognized for that. And, you know, this game deserves to be in the hands of as many gamers who care about games as possible. The next game I want to focus on is called Endless Ocean. It's for the Nintendo Wii also. And I've written on the blog about what I call meditative gaming. And by that, I mean a game that doesn't provide the kind of traditional gaming experiences. You know, we think about how games are built, our very definition of what games are. They're typically designed as rule-based systems. They emphasize competition and they reward you for achievements or higher scores, faster times, and they always give you a certain number of objectives to complete. You know, basically those games have winners and they have losers. That's how you play a game, right? And, you know, games that do that give you a certain kind of reward for your effort. So winning is a reward, faster time is a reward, being somewhere higher on the leaderboard than your friend is a reward. And all of those, you know, basically function as rule-based systems, reinforcing the idea of competitive play. Meditative games really contain none of those elements. And games like Harvest Moon, that whole series of games, a game like Animal Crossing, which, you know, is very popular, but in many ways it's hard to define as a game because really it's just a persistent world that you occupy and it kind of works in cycles through the seasons and you do little things and accomplish little tasks, but other than the satisfaction of doing them, there's no real reward system in the game. I personally find these games very compelling, and I'm very aware that a lot of gamers, probably most gamers, don't. In fact, many gamers would just simply find them boring, and that's fine. But I find that they have a very particular appeal to me, and what it really is that I've sort of long felt that a game like Animal Crossing or Endless Ocean, which I'll talk about here in a second, a game that enables me to focus my attention and persist in a way that I can cultivate a state of mindfulness or a state of concentration, that there is something useful about that experience. It is a quieter, obviously, experience. It allows one to monitor other things about your experience besides the actual game. So, you know, if you think about it as a meditative experience, you could watch your breathing, or you could very carefully manipulate the elements on the screen, or move your character around, or observe the environment, or do things in a very intentional, very careful way. And all of these activities, they tend to enable a kind of quiet means for bringing you back to yourself. You know, Animal Crossing is a great example because it functions around things that have a kind of a inherent meditative quality, planting trees, fishing, exploring. There's a way that you can enjoy the changing of the seasons. These are not very much in vogue when it comes to game design, particularly with competitive, you know, kind of rule-based games. But I do find them appealing. And I think that what we must accept is that video games have all kinds of capacity to compel us on many different levels. And, you know, there should be games that can reach gamers on the level that I'm describing. Certainly not all games by any means, but there ought to be a place for such games. And for me, I'd like to see more of them. So Endless Ocean appeared, and I had read a little bit about it before it came out. And I thought this has, you know, meditative game written all over it. It's a game in which you explore under the ocean. You catalog fish, basically, and you do that by petting them, which they allow you to do, even the sharks. And once you get to know them and make friends with them, basically, they enter into your catalog, and you're basically, you know, an oceanographer. There are very few goals. You have little missions, which are really cursory in the game, and you have no real obligations to anyone in the game other than your own curiosity. So there I was, very excited about this. And of course, it also employs the Wii remote control, which means that you there's a kind of a tactile element to moving through the ocean. Your avatar, the diver, responds to your motion, the Wiimote. So, you know, move your arm left, right, up, down, and that's how he or she swims. So it's really cool that way, and it controls quite nicely. But there's this massively large problem with the game, and it's quite simple. The game denies you the opportunity of true exploration. And it does that because it insists on this dive radius that only allows you to explore a certain distance from your boat. And once you reach the limit of that distance, the game either sort of prevents you from moving anywhere, or it starts draining oxygen from your tank and you have to return to the boat. I'm fully aware that realistic depictions of underwater exploration would insist on a dive radius because that's real life, right? But yeah, it's a video game. It doesn't have to be like real life. And in fact, in my view, the less like real life, the better, usually, with video games. And so what the game prevents you from doing is having that true experience of being able to explore quietly and slowly if you want. You can, but you very quickly explore all there is to explore in that particular area, and then you bump into a kind of an invisible wall. Now, I know there's huge programming issues here, and you know how much of this world can be loaded into the Wii's memory at one time, and blah, blah, blah. I'm aware of all that. You know, I would be perfectly fine with load times as I leave one area and go into another if you just let me stay underwater and explore to my heart's content. Unfortunately, the game forces you to return to the boat, menu screen, load time, choose a different area, navigate the boat there, you know, menu, load time, get out of the boat, dive, load time. It, you know, very, very unfortunate. You know, my high hopes for a meditative gaming experience with Endless Ocean were kind of dashed at that point. So I personally was very disappointed by the game for these reasons, but you know, a lot of people seem to not mind it so much, these limitations, and have found you know, the game to be a lot of fun and have enjoyed that experience. So as they say, your mileage may vary, but for me, Endless Ocean was a bit of a disappointment. Now, the other game that I've been spending my time on is Burnout Paradise, and I'm going to defer my discussion of that to the interview with Mitch Kerpata because we talk about that in the interview, and he's written about that game. I haven't. I would refer you to his blog because he wrote a couple of real interesting pieces, one in favor of the game in a certain way, a list of the things that he really likes about it, and he's a huge fan of the franchise, and then another article about some pretty significant flaws that he sees in the game and that I share his concerns. I would say, though, before the interview, and we don't talk about this so much in the interview, Burnout Paradise does seem to me to represent a kind of a trend and perhaps an unfortunate trend towards these kind of open-ended sandbox worlds, these games that allow you to kind of go off and do anything. That obviously is a GTA thing, and gamers responded so powerfully to that, that it seems clear to me that game designers have been trying to figure out ever since ways of making their games open-ended, regardless of whether that actually serves the design. And I'll talk about this later in the podcast when I answer a listener email about Assassin's Creed, but I felt similarly there that, you know, you had a perfectly wonderful game, or at least a nearly wonderful game with a linear experience that could have been really cool and compelling, but because they sort of forced this non-linear open-ended quality into it, it became a kind of a watered down thing. And I see that in other games too. It's interesting that No More Heroes, which we talked about a minute ago, you know, kind of makes fun of the whole open-ended world. I think Suda does that on purpose because, at least that's how I read it, I think he sees a certain absurdity to the whole open world thing, and he kind of does a lampoon of it in his game. Now, another view of that is that he just didn't do a very good job creating an open-ended world, and that may be true, but I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. So anyway, a little more conversation about Burnout Paradise in a couple of minutes. Real quickly, the last game that I've been playing, and this one's been a great blast, is Rez HD for the Xbox 360 from the Live Arcade download. And if you played Rez, the original Rez on PS2, then you know exactly what this game is. But this is one of those rare occasions where a game that has been reconfigured for another console is very, very well served by that transition. This is Rez like you've never seen it. An extraordinary game. And I'm not going to go, there are all kinds of things we could say about why the game works like it does, and this kind of synesthesia theory that Miyaguchi, the designer, has. But I'll just suggest to you that if you have played Rez and enjoyed it, you should most definitely download it and play it on the 360. If you haven't played Rez, then absolutely must try it on the 360, because it's quite an experience, and it really is a seminal game in the whole music rhythm genre of games, and it's an extraordinary achievement. You'll hear people say this, levels 1 through 4 are cool, but level 5 is what it's all about. I disagree with that a little bit. I think the first 4 levels they're each interesting and, you know, fun to play in their own way, but there's no doubt that when you reach level 5, the whole experience just steps up about 5 notches, and you, even if you're struggling, make your way through those levels. Get a friend over to play level 4 if you can't get past it, whatever, but you must get to level 5. It's, you know, among the most stunning examples of kind of the unified notion of level design and gameplay mechanics and music and all of it just coalescing, and art direction and design, visual elements, all of it just merging into this really cool experience in that level. Really extraordinary. So Rez HD, big thumbs up. Hate thumbs up, thumbs down. But okay, I'm giving you just one time. Thumbs up. Go play it. You'll really enjoy it. Well, I'd like to welcome Mitch Kerpata. Am I pronouncing your name correctly, by the way, Mitch?
That is actually almost completely correct. I pronounce it Kerpata, but
Kerpata.
That was
okay.
Closer than most people ever get.
I want to welcome you to the Brainy Gamer podcast, and you have a terrific blog, and I decided I wanted to feature blogs occasionally on my podcast and let some of my listeners know about them, and I thought you would be a perfect one to start with because I read your blog every day, and I think we have some interesting connections between our two blogs. I also have been following your reviews in the Boston Phoenix, and you also write for Paste Magazine. Right?
Yep, that's correct. I think you got it all.
Excellent. Well, now I'm presuming you're a Secret of Monkey Island fan.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Going obviously way back.
Yeah. So that's where you got the name of the blog from, obviously.
Yeah, actually a friend of mine made it up when he was trying to push me to start a game blog. He just started throwing possible titles out at me. He's like, what about Insult Sword Fighting? I was like, all right, I'll start a video game blog.
Well, now you've been at it for quite a while. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the blog and just maybe find out from you what you were thinking about when you first started it and how it's changed in the... I mean, you've been doing this for a couple of years now, right?
I started it, I think, May of 2006. It was almost 2 years ago. And actually, if you look at the archives, you'll see that I barely posted in it until sometime mid last year. I don't know why. I've been doing reviews for the Phoenix for over 4 years now, and I actually just wanted a place where I could keep all the links to the reviews because they tend to vanish after a couple of months off of that site. So for a while, that was mostly what I was doing, was just putting up a link to my reviews every week. And then suddenly last year, I just got the bug, and I started writing often, and I started writing longer pieces, and I'm not really sure where it came from.
Well, how do you decide what to write about? I mean, this is something I think about on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And you've been doing it longer than I have, much longer. I never seem to run out of material. Do you ever feel sort of up against the wall?
I do. I actually find it helps that if you have more than one idea, you should just write some posts in advance, because quite often I have no idea what to write about. And you know, if you look at the older blog posts, you'll see that there really wasn't anything in there. I don't know, whatever floats my boat, if I keep thinking about it, I think, well, all right, I've been thinking about this for 2 or 3 days now. It's worthy of a post.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're part of a community of bloggers? I noticed that you do post on other people's blogs and they come to your blog, and it seems like there's a kind of a loose network that you're a member of.
It's starting to seem that way, yeah. And that's maybe part of what has been happening recently is... There's Chris Dahlin, who writes the Save the Robot blog. I've known him professionally for a few years. He wrote a little bit for the Phoenix when I was on staff there, and then he brought me aboard Paste when he was the video games editor there. So when I found out he had a blog, I started, you know, commenting on there and reading that. And then I found out that Lee Alexander, who writes Sexy Video Game Land as well as a million other things, actually right. went to high school with me, and we've been both following this track completely independent of one another. So
really, I had no
yeah.
idea. Well, that's how I found
really
that. I came across your blog through her. That I saw the link on her site, and she's my sort of personal blog hero, I have to say.
Yeah.
I love her stuff. I love her take on things, and you know, she had. There's a certain kind of voice she's developed that I really admire.
Yeah, she is extremely fantastic, and I had no idea when we were sitting in AP English class together senior year of high school that, you know, we'd both be doing this, and that, you know, she would especially be doing so well at it, you know, outpacing me by quite a bit.
Well, she lives in New York? I think she lives in Manhattan.
So.
Yeah, is that where you went to school, or were you from somewhere else?
No, we're from, well, I mean, I'm from suburban Massachusetts, and that is where both of us went to high school. I didn't stray too far. I grew up there, and then I went to school in Boston, and have been writing and working in Boston. So.
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the games you've been playing lately, and in particular, you wrote a really terrific review of No More Heroes, a game that we both admire a lot. And you sort of, you know, obviously you wrote about it and you wrote a review about it, but then you kind of extended it and talked about, you know, kind of the creative process behind games, and you and I kind of traded posts about auteur theory and stuff like that. If you were to sort of put your finger on what it is about that game that means something to you, what would that be?
It's a funny thing. I think that when you play most games, you really don't get the sense of the creative force driving it. You know, you tend to, the analogy I came up with is that most games I feel like are sort of machines, and you know, it's almost like an automobile that's been engineered to everything run in perfect harmony, and that's great, but what you don't really get are those sloppy works of genius ever that seem to have just come completely from one person's imagination, warts and all. And playing No More Heroes, it seemed like a lot of people had the same reaction. It really seemed like it had a vision, it had a point of view, which games hardly ever seem to have.
Yeah, yeah. And it seemed to me anyway that this was a big game for us, right? I mean, for you and me and the people who really love video games, it just seemed like we kind of immediately all went crazy for it. And in a certain kind of way, a lot of the blogging that was happening there, and I'm certainly among the people doing this, we were sort of writing to each other in a certain way and getting feedback from each other. And I mean, I've really enjoyed the process. I mean, I love that part of the blogging aspect of life, you know, just getting feedback from people and plowing that back into your own thoughts. And, you know, it really does deepen your understanding of a game like No More Heroes.
It's interesting that you say that, because thinking about it now, I can't recall another game where the dialogue erupted in quite that way. And there are always games that everybody's talking about at the time. You know, everybody was talking about BioShock, for example, but this game really, yeah, you're right, people came together over it, reading, you know, some of the bloggers we talked about earlier and some other ones. We all sort of had a similar reaction. We all had this feeling that here somebody did make a game for us.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think non-gamers would get the same charge out of the game that we got, if, you know, a person who's, or just maybe a casual gamer?
I would love to know. I don't know anybody who has played it who isn't a pretty hardcore gamer, but the fact that it's a Wii game seems sort of risky for the type of game that they actually released.
Yeah.
I think that a casual gamer, and this is, you know, I have no actual data for this is just my gut feeling, probably would be put off by things like, you know, the graphics are jaggy and the open world is not terribly interactive and things like that that they would come to expect. You know, they might see the open world No More Heroes and say, well, this is supposed to be like Grand Theft Auto, which they've probably played, and it's of course nothing like Grand Theft Auto. So I don't know. I'd love to know, especially if it's selling well. You know, that you don't see games as interesting, and usually they just fail.
Yeah, I know. It. I've heard kind of both sides of it. I've heard that it's hard to find because it's sold out places, and then and then I've also heard, well, it died in Japan, and
yeah, actually, I have heard that, but you know, sometimes the markets can be completely different.
Yeah, I'm very confused by Japan. I mean, not even Super Mario Galaxy did terribly well. I can't figure out, other than DS games, what they want to play over there.
Maybe that's it. They just want to play brain training games. It's true, though. I mean, it seems like they're still staying away from the Xbox 360 out of spite.
Yeah.
Just all the arguments in its favor. It's a strange place.
Yeah, yeah. You wrote a couple of reviews, or I guess maybe a couple of essays, I should say, on Burnout, the new Burnout Paradise game, yep. Sort of what's good and what's bad about it. And I don't mean to, you know, make you kind of regurgitate all that you've already written. I'll refer people to your blog when I post the podcast. But can you just talk briefly about, I had a very similar feeling you had about, you know, there's some really wonderful things about this game, but there are some design issues that just don't make a lot of sense.
It's one of those tough things for me, because I love that series so much that when I started playing this game and kept kind of coming across these annoyances, I was like, well, you know, how do I really feel about this? They made the change to the open world design. It always used to be you're going through the menu and, you know, select race event, select this track. And basically they replaced that in the game with some good things about that, and then there are some warts that they didn't, I don't know if they didn't have time to fix them, I don't know if they didn't agree that these things are problems, but it does a few things that I think are against what I have always considered the spirit of Burnout games. I would say that the biggest problem with this game is there are ways in which it rewards stopping, and it was always about going as fast as you could and, you know, the heck with everything else.
Yeah, my experience playing, and I haven't played it, I've maybe put you know, maybe 5 or 6 hours into it. The other two and three, I didn't really play one. I don't know why I didn't play one, but
I actually haven't played that either.
Yeah, 2 and 3, it just gets in your veins. You know, I mean, you know, 3 hours are gone, and you don't even know what happened. And I find this one, it just partly for the reasons you describe it. It, in order for me to get things done, I have to slow down. I have to look around. I have to check the map. I have to.
Yeah.
It's very cumbersome in that way.
When you find yourself doing a 3-point turn trying to get through one of those yellow gates. This is not what I liked about Burnout. It's not even close.
I wonder, and there's some good things too, and we'll talk about those in a second, but one of the concerns I have about the whole sandbox notion is that it's like a lot of video game sort of gameplay mechanic issues where somebody realizes it's good and people like it, and so you figure out a way to plow that into every game, and it seems like I'm seeing a lot of sandbox elements in games that don't necessarily need them.
I think that's exactly true. I think anytime a game does something well, people tend not to look at why it was done well. Another one that happens way too much are those button-pushing quick-time events in action-adventure games. It's like, push A really fast, or else you get slammed by an anvil or something. You know, they do that in every action-adventure game now. Yeah. When it was good in Resident Evil 4 and God of War.
Right. And No More Heroes, they sort of mess with that, which I love. You know, they know we're used to that, and so they kind of turn it on its head.
They're almost poking fun at the whole idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that whole game is full of things that are like, all right, we're supposed to make you do side missions. All right, go mow some lawns. You know, they just push it to the extreme.
But
Burnout Paradise, I understand that they didn't want to keep doing the same thing they'd always been doing. That is a healthy mindset. But it is sort of, they said, well, what is the thing that we're not doing that everybody else does? It's, you make the open world, you make these hidden collectibles that people can find and get achievements, and it doesn't all fit, and some of it gets away from what they really had been doing so well for so many years.
Yeah. It obviously has some terrific features, too. You mentioned this in your review, and I agree that there's the seamlessness with which you can go from single player into multiplayer, especially if you've been through a lot of Xbox Live, you know, experiences where that's just so problematical. It's all, you can almost even do it accidentally. If you happen to hit it with your finger, suddenly you're online. But I have to say, you know, that opened up some possibilities in my mind of how to deal with online, offline in other games that, you know, seem pretty exciting to me.
I would certainly hope so. I mean, the old model now of sitting in the lobby and waiting for players to join, it's somewhere you see somebody do this done well once, and you say, everybody has to do this.
Exactly.
I've had some instances on the PlayStation 3 where I've been sitting there for, 5 minutes waiting for enough people to show up to play.
Yeah.
But that's just because nobody owns one of those yet. But, you know, part of it, too, though, is that because of the way they've structured Burnout Paradise, is there's a lot of that kind of free play. I think they call it free burn, where they're not doing structured race events, and therefore it is easy for you to just appear in that game world, and it doesn't have an effect so much on what everybody else is trying to do.
Right.
So, you know, I can't imagine it would be so easy for something like a deathmatch in Halo, but you would think maybe for co-op mode in a lot of games, maybe it would be possible to hop in that quickly. I'm not sure.
Well, I may be wrong about this, but I think I recall you mentioning that you actually, in general, prefer single player to multiplayer.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, and I know it's kind of a weird, I guess bias is the word, I'll say it. But yeah, generally, I prefer single player narrative games. I'm not a huge fan of just jumping in with a bunch of strangers and trying to win. I don't really find that interesting.
Yeah, I'm the same, and I'm finding the older I get, the more I feel that way. And overall, presuming there's going to be a Burnout 4.
I don't even know what it would be.
I don't know. Whatever that will call it.
I think it would actually be 6.
6,
if they made
okay.
a sequel to this one, yeah.
Does it seem to you, what should they keep and what should they throw out? Sort of how can they piece together what they've got here and make it the ideal Burnout from your point of view?
Well, let's see. I would really like the option to restart an event. Their whole thing was they did not want to stop the gameplay ever. They wanted it to always be continuous. Right. But as a result, you know, you can get stuck in these events where there's no clear way out. You know, you make one stupid mistake and you can't just start over when you have this goal in mind. It really thwarts you. So either you drive back across the map to where you were, or you just go do something else. I would like to see that changed somehow. And you know, I have been complaining about the unlockables, the 400 yellow gates that you can crash through, which are kind of helpful because they are usually shortcuts. But I would like it if they were going to stick with that, if it helped you more in the game, if crashing through those somehow made you faster or stronger or better.
Right.
You know, made your car more powerful somehow, because otherwise it's just this kind of useless side thing that it's there. There's no real reason to pursue it except that you like achievement points.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no payoff. And I don't, this may be just because I'm kind of navigationally, you know, impaired, but I cannot figure the city out. I'm constantly lost. I don't know where I am, and it seems like I make a turn thinking I can find some place to repair my car, and I'm driving for 10 minutes trying to find a place to repair my car. It's really annoying.
It's tough because there's two different ways, actually I think three different ways that you can navigate, and in order to do it successfully you have to sort of synthesize all of them while also driving extremely fast and trying to avoid oncoming traffic. There's the mini map, which helps you plan your route if you can look at it long enough to think of it that way. There's the compass during a race event that gives you a general idea of where you're going, and the street signs are usually really helpful. It, you know, there's the main one on the top that tells you what street you're on, and in a race event, if there's a turn that you should make, an optimal turn, it'll sort of flash and blink fairly obviously to let you know to make the turn, although I have to admit, the first maybe hour or so of the game, I never noticed because I was too busy. I was like hunkered down trying to make people crash, and I had no idea that the game was giving me this help. So it is all in there. It's just not, I don't know if it's as good as it could be.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't beat Takedown.
No. No, I think that's the best one.
I notice as you think and write about games on your blog that you you seem to have a kind of a hopeful attitude about games, about sort of where we are now, but where we're going in the future too. Is that a fair characterization of how you see things?
I think so. I mean, I really like video games, and I'm 26 years old, so I'm of this generation that has now literally grown up with video games.
Right.
You know, we had the Atari 2600 in the house as young as I can ever remember. I was probably 3 years old. And so for me, this is something that, you know, I know it's not a fad. I know it's not going anywhere. So I just want to see it only, what's the best way to phrase this? I want it to achieve that kind of respectability that books had to fight for, and that music had to fight for, and that movies had to fight for. I think that we're at that point, and I think they're going to get there. Yeah, I just think that what it'll actually take is for those of us who play it to start taking them more seriously and not just, you know, not call them just a game every time somebody criticizes them.
Right. So that there you fit on something that I've been thinking about. I've been trying to concoct some kind of a post on this, and I stumble over myself. But
yeah,
it seems to me that you can blame the sort of the culture or a sense of there are plenty of old people that think it's all just silly toys, but I think one of the biggest barriers is us. It's gamers. It's this, you know, really low set of expectations we have about games, in my view, and this kind of odd carping that happens on forums or wherever you go, where, you know, the minute somebody stands up and says, you know, this game means something, or this game spoke to me, or, you know, we should strive for something artistic, you just get like pounded by these people who say, I just want to play games, shut the hell up.
Yeah, you wrote a post about that, and I thought it was pretty interesting that there is this resistance among a lot of people to really embracing what games actually can be. And it's, I don't know that it's the majority of people, but it's, you see it most when somebody who isn't a gamer actually criticizes something, rightly or wrongly. We hardly ever defend our games on the merits. It actually did happen with this recent Mass Effect sex controversy. But with if you remember the Resident Evil 5 trailer that came out last summer,
right,
somebody said that really seems racist to me, and instead of anybody being the voice of reason and saying, actually, let me explain to you what these games are about, this is actually about, you know, a corporation preying on helpless people, people said, you know, it's just a game, just relax. And, you know, actually, in saying that there was no way it was racist, I actually read a whole lot of racist comments toward the person who had made the complaint.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we do tend to hurt ourselves in a lot of ways when we should be taking this a lot more seriously, I think.
Yeah. Well, insult sword fighting does that. I mean, seriously, you do that a lot. You think seriously about games in ways that are accessible for people to read. And, you know, I think you tend to point at things that matter and that are worth getting worked up about rather than the kind of trivial things that we sometimes see people getting worked up about.
Well, I appreciate that. That is extremely nice to hear. It's good to know I'm not just complaining.
I promised that I wouldn't go too long, and I'll keep my promise. One little mini feature, which I'm going to try to start with you and see if I can extend it into other interviews that I do with games bloggers, is what I'm going to call kind of a Last Supper game, as opposed to like a Desert Island game or whatever. My thinking about Desert Island game would be you would all, if you only had one game to take to a desert, you would take something very open-ended that you could just play forever.
You could play forever.
Yeah. So this is your last game, you know, before you leave this mortal coil, and you have the chance to tell me what it would be. Do you have one?
Well, I think so. It's funny when you phrase it that way. It's a little bit different than just saying what my favorite game of all time is, but I think
it's different.
I think I'll go with that anyway. I think if I could only play one more game, it would probably have to be Resident Evil 4.
And why?
Because it is a game that just continually raises the stakes from the very opening scene. It never stops getting scarier or more dangerous, and I've never felt more exhilarated from playing through a game when I just kept surviving the challenges it was throwing at me. And if I had my Last Supper game, that's the last feeling I would want to have.
How long did it take you to kill that creature in the lake?
It took a couple tries.
I don't know why. That was like, some people told me about really hard sections that were easy for me. I think it took me 10 times to beat that thing.
Actually, this is embarrassing. I've played Resident Evil 4 maybe 4 or 5 times, which is just ridiculous because I don't get to play anything that much anymore, but I like this game that much. And it wasn't until I played the Wii version last summer that I realized in the first battle against El Gigante that you can run up to him and stab him while you're feeling over. So I was always running out of ammo and having no idea what to do, and I still played the game several times before I figured that out.
Oh, well. You know, the Wii version, my first thought was they were cashing in, and, you know, there are all these people with Wiis and no serious games, so they'll buy it. But I thought it was terrific. I mean, I thought it was an excellent version. In fact, it's my preferred way of playing that game is on the Wii.
I think so. They made it, it couldn't, there wasn't much that they could have done to improve it, but they did improve it, and they took what I thought was the best game ever made and made it a little bit better. So, yeah, if I would put remakes on my top 10 list, that would have been top 10 with a bullet last year, even with everything else that came out.
Well, Mitch, I'm very grateful for your time, and I am thoroughly enjoying your work and hope that you'll continue. And I especially appreciate you being willing to spend time with me on my podcast.
Well, it was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Take care, Mitch, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before I get to listener email, I promised I'd talk about Spore, and so I'm going to do that. I'll only spend a couple of minutes on it because there's plenty of time between now and the release date for us to explore what this game's going to be about. But at least we have a release date, and that's something we've been waiting for quite some time. Spore, it was announced yesterday. The release date for Europe is September 5th and North America September 7th. So, and they seem to say that's firm. This is a long delayed game. I think it was originally shown back in 2005, early 2006, and actually maybe even before that, I can't recall. It's of course designed by Will Wright, the creator of The Sims and many other really cool games. And, you know, to say that this game is ambitious would be to understate it. In case you're not familiar with it, I'll give you a quick rundown of what Spore is allegedly all about. The game was originally called Sim Everything because it's essentially an attempt to try to simulate life from its, you know, multi-cell organism state all the way through various stages of evolution and development, all the way till, you know, you're colonizing planets in outer space. So the game breaks down into several phases. There's a tide pool phase where you're you know, kind of a microbial creature. Then the creature phase, and the player has a big hand in creating, you know, what the creature looks like and its characteristics. There's the tribal phase, which, you know, after your species evolves enough to have a kind of brain capacity, then you enter this tribal phase. That's succeeded by a civilization phase, and then finally a space phase. And the space phase, from what I understand, is essentially going to be like a sandbox mode where, you know, once you get to space, then it's open-ended gameplay from that point on. So we knew that. That was stuff that had been announced long ago. But what's emerged most recently are details about how the game works in a kind of social networking context. So what Wright is telling us is that when you make something in the game, and you're constantly making things. You make creatures, you create your spaceship, from what I understand. You know, everything is the product of player creation. You make this stuff and it all gets compressed and sent up to the servers where you're able to fill out your ecosystem, as he describes it, your galaxy, your opponents, cities, vehicles. And all of this stuff is coming out of database content that other players have created. So you are adding to this content and you are drawing from this content. And if you have friends or people that you value more than others, that content gets prioritized in terms of what makes it into your world. So what Wright is suggesting is that the player has all this control over all kinds of stuff. And I'm reading here from an interview that N'Guy Kroll did with Will Wright on his Newsweek games blog. And Wright describes it like this. I can make a buddy list and it will try to put my buddy's content in my universe at a higher priority. I can subscribe to Sporecasts, which are aggregations of content that players have decided to basically organize themselves. Also, when I get a card for a piece of content, whether it be mine or someone else's, at any time I can open that card and leave a comment on the card, and the person who made that content will get the comment. It's like a guest book for every card. So the idea is there's going to be a running community discussion group based around the content where every piece is thrown its own discussion thread. So you add things like Flickr tagging of content and stuff like that so people can search what's going to be a really large database of content. So what's become clear is that this social networking aspect of the gameplay is going to be an extraordinarily big part of the experience. That's in addition to all of the other gameplay elements, which have both a linear kind of progression. There is a way of making your way through the game in a fashion that the game kind of leads you toward, or there's this open-ended side of it as well that you get to eventually, and of course all this content creation. It's mind-boggling, and I don't know of a single gamer who cares about games that isn't at least a little bit excited about Spore, if not, you know, genuinely just completely head over heels about the idea that Spore represents and the kind of evolution of video games. I'm real interested and also very concerned because it just seems like a great big bite of innovation, and you wonder how much can Will Wright and his team sort of chew all at once. You know, they have a tremendous amount of resources behind them. EA is funding this, and from what I understand, it's kind of sort of the sky's the limit. Whatever Will Wright wants, Will Wright gets, and apparently unlimited amounts of time. But it does seem that it's finally going to appear, and I just thought I would let you know about some of the more recent stuff that we've learned about the game, and we'll keep our fingers crossed. Okay, it's time for listener mail. And first of all, thank you very much for all of the email and the responses that you give me on a regular basis to the podcast. It's terrific and it means a lot to me. Several of you have asked me about my little 10-week-old daughter, Zoe. And thanks a lot for being interested. She's doing great. In fact, and this is exclusive to this podcast, she has a special message. This is actually, so get your pencils. These are instructions for how to beat the final boss at the end of Resident Evil 4. This is in honor of Mitch Kerpata's visit to the Brainy Gamer. So pencils ready, here it comes. Okay, so did you get that? All right, good. Now, follow those directions and you'll have that boss beat in no time. Best of luck. Okay, so on to listener email. So the first message is from Christopher Hyde. And Christopher, thank you very much for your kind remarks about the podcast. It means a lot to me. Thank you very much. His question is an interesting one. And he puts it like this. It's my contention that the one thing that's currently lacking in the video game arena is a broad historical overview of how we have got to this point, because I've always felt that any art cannot be understood completely without a full understanding of the roots of that art. So far, there have been a handful of popular works that sketch the outlines of video game history or delve into the story of a particular company or a specific person. But as far as I know, there's been no thoroughly researched, academically acceptable history of the medium that places it in a global context. And he goes on to say that he has read a couple of these books that cover aspects of gaming, and they're lacking in one way or another, which I agree. And he just wants to know, you know, where that book is. Well, Christopher, your ship may have come in, because there is a new book just released by an author by the name of Mark J.P. Wolf. I interviewed Mark early on in the life of the blog. This was probably within the first month of beginning the blog. And at that time, the book was finished or about to be finished and going to press. And it turns out that the book is now released. It's called The Video Game Explosion: A History from Pong to PlayStation and Beyond. And according to the description of the book, he's basically tracing the growth of video games as a kind of global phenomenon. He covers games and gaming culture from like the late 70s on, some coverage of corporations and arcade culture, freestanding video consoles, home-based handheld gaming devices. The list of things that he says that the book covers looks pretty comprehensive to me. Now, having said that, I haven't read it. I don't know much about it beyond that, but I do know that Mark is a serious writer and has been writing about video games for as long as anybody. Now, a couple of things, one of them encouraging in some ways and perhaps one less encouraging. The book is 400 pages long, so, you know, it's a tome, and that could be good, because if it's comprehensive and it sounds like that's what you're looking for, this may be the book. Now, here's the downside. If you go to Amazon and look for it, they've got it only in hardcover, and it's $75. Yeah, ouch. So depends on how much you want that history, Christopher. But if you're willing to spend $75, you can order it from Amazon. There are currently no reviews of the book online there, and so it's really hard to know. I don't know any colleagues who've read it, and like I said, I haven't read it. But I look forward to seeing it, and hopefully this is the book you're looking for. The next email is from Nathaniel, and he has a question about buggy games. And here it is. I was wondering what your thoughts were on publishers rushing game titles. I can remember a time when a studio had one shot at making a game right the first time. Now, however, we live in a world of patches. Games like Vanguard and Hellgate London came out in a near beta state, and it really bothers me as an aspiring designer. I realize it is a business and there are deadlines, but when is art sacrificed for money? Well, you know, this is an emerging problem, I think, a growing problem, because of the fact that, you know, we're sort of all perpetually online, and all the consoles are online, basically, and of course PCs. So pretty much any game you get, with the exception of maybe DS games, are going to have, you know, online connections that will entice the developers to fix them if they aren't quite ready for release time, which is really unfortunate. Off the top of my head, I can't quote this exactly, but, you know, Miyamoto was famous for saying something like, if you release a game late, your audience will soon forget that it was late, but if you release a buggy game, they'll never forget it was bad. And that's a pretty darn good rule of thumb. You know, you'll notice that companies like Blizzard, Valve, Nintendo very rarely release buggy games, but they also often miss their release dates. And there are other companies you could say the same for. You know, I don't really have a problem with missed release dates. I know there's a certain pressure with video games becoming a medium that is supposed to compete with film and, you know, TV and things like that. And those never miss their deadlines, right? I mean, a show that's going to open in the fall on a certain date on TV, it's going to be there. And the same thing for a movie. They tell you a year ahead when it's coming out, and it's definitely coming out on that day. And there's some sense that, well, you know, if video games are to count or to be as good as movies or film or taken as seriously, they need to hit their launch dates. I don't know if I agree with that. You know, it doesn't really matter to me. There are certain titles like sports games. You know, you know that the Madden franchise, those games have to come out on a certain day, absolutely. And it seems clear they've cut features out of those titles occasionally in some years because they absolutely have to meet those dates. But otherwise, I don't mind a game being released late, and I think game makers that are willing to get it right deserve our loyalty and they deserve our appreciation for doing what they should do in the first place, right? Putting out a game that works. You mentioned Hellgate London, and I'm not going to go off on this, but you know, I put a little time into that game just to see what it was all about, and it was simply unplayable. I mean, unconscionable to release a game in that state, a disaster. And it's unfortunate because some really cool people worked on that game. Who knows whose fault it is, but some really interesting ideas. The setting of that game, I just thought, what a great place to put that game environmentally. It was just awesome. But it was so annoying. And I know I'm one of many people who were really, you know, pissed off about that game. And of course, they charge you full price, right? So you pay the money, and then you get this broken game. Those companies should be punished for that. You know, it's ultimately going to come down to these publishers insisting on games being ready, and us demanding that they be ready. As long as we keep buying games that need to be patched, they'll keep releasing them. Okay, looking at the clock on the wall here, I'm going to do two more emails, and then I'll wrap it up. This one is from Ben Abraham, a good friend of the blog and a frequent visitor. Hi, Ben. He wants to know what I thought of Assassin's Creed. You have played Assassin's Creed, right? He says. I just wondered whether you enjoyed it as much as I did and had any thoughts on its review scores. He felt that it was unjustly rated down because it's more of a free-form game. But his opinion was if you played it more like a linear adventure, it would be less boring, which was the accusation of some critics. But I think what he's really getting at is this, and this is what he writes. My real question boils down to what you think about the mindset behind game reviews and the need to finish to be able to assess the game, when in many cases the game is the journey, not the destination. And he wonders, how would a game reviewer review a meditative style game? They would have great difficulty or they would miss the point of the game if they were looking for some kind of, you know, completion point. So, Ben, that, you know, Assassin's Creed, you know, I'm hardly the first person to suggest that the reviews were all over the map for that one and a very controversial game in that regard. Boy, I wish I could say I liked it as much as you. It really was for me, first of all, very repetitive. I felt that the game is so beautiful and the environments are so exquisitely constructed that it says explore, you know, like get off the beaten path, take a look at the city, have fun, and don't worry about the linearity of it. You can do the linear thing if you want, but the game seemed to be so lovingly constructed and yelling to me, explore me, you know. So you do that and you wind up kind of talking to the same kind of people and doing the same kinds of things over and over as kind of like submissions. And I just found it very repetitive. Granted, if you stay on the linear path, as you describe, the game probably has a more of a directed kind of put together feel. But, you know, if the game is going to encourage you to get off the beaten path, then and then not reward you for that, I think that's kind of a pretty big flaw. Now, having said that, you know, I think your question more to the point is, how does a game reviewer go into a game? What mindset should he or she have in thinking about the experience of a game? And there, I really do think you raise a very useful point. I have read reviews that seem to me to be all about the bullet points. You know, you go down the list of all the things that the game says on the box that it's going to do, and then you say, well, you know, how to do those things. Okay, 7.9. Whereas for me, often games are much more experiential, and they're that what they have to offer the gamer is less about checkpoints and completion and, you know, achievement points or whatever, and more about how that game feels. A great example of a game like that that I played recently is Aquaria, an independent game, which really is to me all about the experience. It is in some ways a kind of a derivative design. And if you were to review the game on that level, you know, the kind of the bullet points, yes, it has a kind of a Castlevania structure, but not as good as Castlevania, and the levels aren't as interesting. So, you know, 6.2. but you missed the point of the world of the game, the way that the music is infused, the way that you can just swim around and make her do little acrobatics in time to the music that you're also creating. It's an experiential game. So I think your point there is that if you treat that game like a traditional structured game, it's got to be counted down for X, Y, and Z points, and often not given nearly the credit it deserves for the rich experience that it gives you playing it on its own terms. So I hope that was somewhere close to an answer. Sorry if I rambled a little bit there, but I think I see your point, and in general, I think I agree with it. I wish I liked Assassin's Creed more. Finally, I received an email from Richard Terrell. Richard, if it's Terrell, I apologize. I wasn't sure how to pronounce your name. Richard has started a new blog called Critical Gaming. I'll put the address in my show notes. And this guy, he's a very ambitious guy. Let me tell you, he's a 20-year-old, you know, I'm sorry, I want to call him a kid because 20-year-old, you know, you're still a kid to me, sort of. But he's a young man who started a blog, a podcast. He's a programmer. He's designing a game, a music game, which he's calling Guitar RPG. And he's calling it a true music game because it's not a kind of a music rhythm game. His attempt is to create a game that's cooperative. It's a cooperative adventure where you kind of weave music theory into the core design. When I was chatting with him recently online, and I said, you know, what are you working on? He said, I'm creating a new genre of video game. So, you know, if that ain't ambitious, I don't know what ambitious is. And, you know, his podcast is kind of trying to take into account a lot of the other podcasts that are going on and issues raised on other podcasts. He's trying to, you know, kind of network with other people. So a little shout out to Richard and his Critical Gaming blog and podcast. I would encourage you to go check it out and, you know, support a guy who's given it all up for the game design, video game blog, video game podcast, anything you can think of with video games. This guy's wrapped up in it and enthusiastic, and I say more power to you, my friend. Well, that's it for this podcast. I want to thank you very much for joining me. I had a great time, and I hope you did. I'm off to the Game Developers Conference next week, which I could not possibly be more excited about. I've never been to one, and I'm just thrilled to death. I'm going to be attending all kinds of really cool sessions on all kinds of amazing, interesting subjects to me, and I'll be blogging from there on a daily basis, or I guess nightly basis, because I'll be doing these blog entries late at night, I imagine. And if I can podcast from there, I'll do that too, but we'll see. I'll bring some equipment with me. But anyway, keep your eye on brainygamer.com for up-to-date information about GDC and some cool announcements that I'm sure will be made. And hopefully I'll be able to hook up with some of you bloggers out there that I love and admire, and we'll have a chance to meet each other in person. So thanks for joining me on the Brainy Gamer podcast. See you next time.